I call the meeting of the Higher Education Finance and Policy Division to order. We do have a quorum present and may have a motion to approve the minutes for March 30th, 2019.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Poppe. Representative Poppe moves approval of the minutes for March 30th, 2019. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 30th, 2019 are approved. We do have a busy agenda today, and we have Representative Kaler with her House File 405 bill up first. Okay. And so, Representative Cagle, we have like 10 to 15 minutes for this bill, and so...
You can do it quicker.
Oh, great. Excellent.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So, House File 405 is a $200,000 appropriation to Anoka Technical College to purchase equipment and software for a fabrication lab, and it would be shared between Anoka Technical College and the STEP education program through Anoka Hennepin. And so, with that, I'll just leave it up to the experts here. I have a couple testifiers with me.
Welcome to committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate this. My name is Jessica Lipa, and I am the director of the STEP program, which is the Secondary Technical Education Program in Anoka Hennepin School District. Our partnership with Anoka Technical College and Anoka Hennepin School District is a very unique partnership. We're a school building that was built right onto Anoka Technical College, serving Anoka Hennepin schools and other area school students as well, but we serve all five high schools from Anoka Hennepin School District. Together, we respond to the demands of our workforce and by preparing our students for post-secondary careers, particularly in post-secondary credentials, industry-recognized credentials, and concurrent enrollment opportunities, ensuring that our high school students have the opportunities to take advantage of seamless education pathways resulting in post-secondary credentials. In our area, in the Anoka County area in particular, the demand for manufacturing and advanced manufacturing skills is very high. It's 20% of all of our careers, which tends to be higher than that of the rest of Minnesota. And those careers are continuing to grow. The local business community sees our collaboration and partnership between STEP and Anoka Tech as a pathway to meeting the critical, technical, and academic demands of our workforce and improving our community's economy. We need programs that are innovative and ensure that all of our students have the opportunities to gain these skills. And this opportunity would help us to implement advanced manufacturing and provide our students with real-world relevant experiences, innovation, collaboration, and an in-depth experience in high-skill, high-wage, and high-demand careers. Implementing advanced manufacturing in our community will help us to strengthen that transition by providing our students with the technology, curriculum, and opportunities for expanding our industry credentials and our concurrent enrollment and in further advancing us. Because of that, we believe that we can partner with further opportunities with Anoka Technical College, Anoka Ramsey Community College, and engage our high school students, our college students, and local business and industry, and we would greatly support this bill. And with that, I'll introduce our guest from Anoka Technical College, and he can kind of talk to us from there.
Okay, thank you for being here, and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Matthew Rogers. I'm a machine trades instructor at Anoka Technical College, and the part of the partnership that will be utilizing this appropriation of $200,000. I would first like to thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm here a lot on behalf of our local employers. There is extremely high need in the manufacturing sector in Anoka County. And what this Fab Lab would help open up is an opportunity for parents to see more of the opportunities within the two-year technical programs that we offer. They're very high-paying jobs with a low cost of tuition. Arguably, most of our students make more money coming directly out of a two-year program than most students coming out of a four-year program. We've had quite a few students that have actually graduated from four-year programs come back and go through our two-year program and get a job while they're in the process of taking those courses in our program. I would say we actually just had a signing day at the college for high school students through the Anoka Area Chamber of Commerce, and we had around about 75 to 100 students sign a letter of intent basically to pursue careers in manufacturing. But honestly, that's kind of a drop in the bucket. Today I had a manufacturer on our floor before I came here looking to set up an internship program to get more students involved in manufacturing careers because the need is that great. And the pay is not bad either. It's on average is $77,000 a year. So honestly, I did the math really quick and figured out that the tax base from the Minnesota state income tax for that amount of people to cover the $200,000 would be about 37 students that go through our program and get careers in manufacturing would pay for this $200,000 worth of appropriation. So with that, thank you.
And happy to answer any questions.
Answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who wants to answer this. I guess my fundamental question is, for some of us who don't understand what the fabrication lab, you talk about manufacturing, what exactly would this lab for this fabrication thing?
So what this lab and the equipment that is involved in it and the softwares allows for the community to be more open to allow them to come in instead of taking classes, that they can experience things that have to do with manufacturing through welding, machining, fabrication and assembly, electronics, a wide variety of different disciplines that are involved in manufacturing. So the way I talk to parents mostly when they come in with their students is we're those nondescript buildings that you drive past that are nobody knows who they are, but they have really nice cars outside of them. Those are those type of businesses. So to get more people acclimated to what those fields are and what they entail and the high technology and skills that are involved as well. Does that answer your question?
Madam Chair, I assume that you're already kind of down that road a little bit already with your program.
Yeah, with the college program we are, but like I said, what this Fab Lab would more entail is trying to get parents more acclimated. There's a lot of stigma that a student should pursue a four-year education. Whereas we're trying to actually build our program to dovetail with a four-year program so that a student can graduate with a low amount of debt, a high-paying career, and then be able to go back later and gain that four-year to then forward their career later on in further disciplines like engineering, sales, management, so on and so forth.
Representative Dornes? Just one more question. Does Minnesota State get involved here? Is there a priority list? Do you need to go to them to tell them what you're planning to do? Or are you pretty independent on setting your own course?
Yes.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, is it Ms. Lipa?
Lipa,
okay.
Yes, they are involved because the appropriation will be going to Minnesota State. So we do involve Minnesota State, and we, of course, work with the school president. But it's in conjunction with Anoka Hennepin, and so that's what makes it this a little unique in that much of our equipment is already shared on an annual basis. They purchase things, we purchase things, and so we do combine funding when we can and braid our funding together. So there is that's part of the reason that makes this a little bit more a little different and a little more unique is that our fundings are already braided.
Okay, thanks.
And then before we go on to the next question, I just want to move House File 405 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have I think I got a chance to tour that technical college a couple of years ago. If I remember it, there was a pretty big diesel mechanics set up in the back, and a lot of the stuff was donated, nothing like that. A lot of the engines, a lot of the tractors were donated. And I'm just wondering, if it says machinery in the bill, is some of the machinery used, I'm assuming it's not brand new because you couldn't buy one CNC machine for that kind of dollars, but is it new or used, and did you find that with the things that you're offering that your numbers, pupil numbers are going up or staying the same or going down?
To answer your question kind of a couple different ways, through this committee, actually, the Leverage Equipment Program has helped our program immensely. So we have been able to purchase $100,000 pieces of equipment that are current to the industry. So we are working towards that end as well. This equipment that would be purchased would also be new. But we do also take quite a bit of donations, and we utilize both ends of that spectrum with our local businesses who are, like I said, very much in the game on this. They need people desperately.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Ms. Lipa.
Thank you. Another aspect of this is that simultaneously, Anoka-Hennepin School District, within the last 2 years, is finally developing a pathway in manufacturing starting in ninth grade. That wasn't there previously, so now our students are in 10th grade, and and there are now hundreds of students across the school district going through manufacturing courses and new courses that are being developed. And so this will be kind of that final step for some of those students to further engage in their 11th and 12th grade year. And so that is, our numbers are going up considerably because we didn't have, I would say, a very strong manufacturing pathway across all five of our high schools at the time, but now we are developing that in the process in conjunction with our business community and with Anoka Technical College.
Thank you. And we have one member left to ask a question, and Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe you did touch on this, but I just wanted to ask a little bit more about the leveraged equipment fund, and I know that there is funds available that you can access, and so I just wanted clarification. So you've tried to do that for this project, or you have not? And just maybe a little bit more about that.
The leveraged equipment program is structured, we do utilize that within the college program. So outside companies will donate us materials, equipment, tooling, things like that that are obsoleted. And the cash value against that will go to purchase new equipment. This Fab Lab is more to try and buy entry-level type of equipment and software so that a student who has not been introduced in any way, shape, or form to manufacturing can get a taste of it, and the parents can understand it as well to kind of onboard them to the manufacturing opportunities that are available through the college. Does that answer your question?
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But this could qualify for leveraged equipment as a request. Is that correct?
I don't know how that works between the high school system.
Ms. Lipa. No, not if it's intended for primarily for high school students. My understanding is it does not, and that's why the need.
Thank you.
Okay. Would you like to any final comments, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a really neat opportunity to see kind of the interaction between the high school's higher education business and also expanding in manufacturing, like the testifiers said. So thank you for hearing it.
Yeah, thank you very much. And so with that, with no further discussion, I'll renew the motion for House File 504 be laid over for possible inclusion in the higher education omnibus bill.
Thank you.
The motion passes. Okay, so Representative Noir, welcome to our committee. I've always appreciated your enthusiasm for the Higher Education Committee, and I know you wanted to be serving on this committee, and so we're happy you are here today.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members, and I'm delighted to be here.
And Representative Noir, just before we get started, I'd like to move your House File 434 be laid over for the possible inclusion. And then we have 30 minutes set aside for this testimony today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also have an amendment
to
put the bill in the shape that I want.
Okay.
It's A190345.
Okay, I would like to move Amendment A190345. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, the motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you have seen the bill, this is one of the major issues that we've been dealing with when it comes to addressing the teacher shortage, especially for teachers of color and indigenous. The growth of students of color has gone significantly high in the school system. I don't know if you have all seen the report in Stat Tribune. The growth has gone up to 34%. While the teachers of color has remained stagnant at 5% or 4%, depending on how you look at the data. Madam Chair and members, this is a challenge that we all have. This is a moment that we all have to be courageous in addressing a major challenge in our school system. We cannot let the opportunity gap and the education gap keep on repeating. The persistent issue of seeing our students fail and able to provide them a quality education starts with having somebody who looks like them teaching them what they need to learn. A student who doesn't get exposed to the traditions and the background of an individual who will understand them is a significant barrier for kids to succeed. My wife is a second grade teacher. My kids go to the school that my wife teaches. So this shows that she went through a process whereby she didn't start being a teacher, but because of her passion to be in the classroom, because she wanted to serve the students who needed help. She stepped up. She went through the program at the University of Minnesota through the Grow Your Own. When I was in the school board, you know, we really addressed it. I was part of Minneapolis Public Schools. We put the Grow Your Own as a priority to create a pathway for the assistants who were in the classroom, who knew that they had to step up, and they took advantage of that. So this bill addresses a major crisis that we have in our school system, but it also addresses the challenges for teachers of color to get the resources in order to become licensed teachers. So this bill creates several components to address that challenge. But with me today to go over some of the amendments, I have some great individuals who have been advocating for this program. Madam Chair and members, I wanted to invite the group that has been promoting the teachers of color and indigenous or Native American teachers to come forward and testify on this bill.
Okay, thank you. Who is going to be our first testifier? If the next testifier wants to grab that chair and join up there, that would be excellent.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Shannon Gijic. I'm from the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. My colleagues from the other state ethnic councils and I are giving joint testimony together on this bill. And really quickly, we have a letter that we drafted, and if I could respectfully request assistance from one of the pages to hand out this letter, I would appreciate that. Thank you. As state agencies, we have the important statutory role to advise and inform elected officials about our constituent communities and their needs. Students from our communities currently represent 34% of all students in Minnesota, which is an increase from 24% just a decade ago. Meanwhile, the percentages of teachers of color and American Indian teachers in the state has remained the stagnant 4% over that same decade, and this severe shortage is one of the main reasons we continue to have some of the nation's worst achievement gaps. As you know, these gaps extend into higher education, where only 25% are students from our communities, and the severe shortage of diverse E-12 teachers limits our collective ability to reach the state's official higher education attainment goals.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Jasmine Carey. I'm with the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. In 2006, state law amended several statutes asserting that all students shall have improved and equitable access to effective and diverse teachers who reflect the diversity of students in their schools. For your reference, there is a handout in your package, which lists the percentage of students of color and American Indian students in every school district that each member of this committee represents. To further highlight the severe shortage statewide, please consider if all students had equitable access to diverse teachers now, Minnesota would have 18,506 more teachers of color and American Indian teachers than the 2,745 who are currently teaching full-time. Therefore, addressing the severe shortage of teachers of color and American Indian teachers has been the top priority in education for our councils over the past biennium and the current session.
Thank you. Ms. Carey, could you just point out, where did you say, do you have something in here that we can look at, did you say?
Madam Chair, the racial diversity.
Okay, gotcha.
Student you. Racial diversity of all your districts should be in your packet.
Awesome. Thank you. And welcome to the committee, Ms. Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My colleague, Katie Sly from the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, couldn't be here. She's testifying in another hearing. So I will read her portion of this testimony, but it is a part of our four council joint testimony. Madam Chair and members, HF 434, House File 434, is a crucial part of the more comprehensive E-12 bill, House File 824, known as the 2019 Increased Teachers of Color Act, which has gained a lot of positive attention and bipartisan support this session, including from several of you in this committee. I also note that Senator Paul Anderson is one of the Republican co-authors of the Increased Teachers of Color Act in the Senate. Please also know that this carefully crafted bill is based on feedback from hundreds of people from our communities over the past 2 years and the initial implementation of the Teacher Candidate Grant Program. It is also the result of several drafts being vetted over several months prior to session by our councils, the Office of Higher Education, and a wide variety of education organizations that has resulted in consensus and endorsements from nearly 50 organizations. Madam Chair and members, together, House File 434 and its historic parent, House File 824, will support diverse candidates to stay in teaching majors and complete their unpaid student teaching internship experience required for licensure. House File 434, as amended, addresses our main funding priorities this session, which are student teacher grants and the Aspiring Teachers of Color Scholarship Program. These programs are needed in order to provide direct financial support to hundreds of diverse teacher candidates, so that our state can finally start increasing the percentage of teachers of color and American Indian teachers above 4%. We ask that you please consult with our councils and the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota during the development of your omnibus bill and conference committee negotiations. We thank you for your leadership on this issue and for hearing this important bill. I am not sure I stated my name for the record.
No, you did not, but I...
My apologies. Violeta Hernandez Espinosa. From the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Spies. If you could say your name for the record and who you're affiliated with, and that'd be great. If you're going, are you going next?
I'm going to go first. Madam Chair and members, my name is Paul Spies, and I'm speaking today as a member of the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota. The coalition, led by a majority of people of color, formed 3 years ago when 40 people said we have to do better and for systemic change to work together and make a difference in the number of teachers of color we have. We have now 1,300 members in our coalition from throughout the state in just 3 years. I'd like to draw your attention to another handout that you have. There's a handout that lays out what the appropriation ask is before your committee, and as well the other side data that says how many current candidates there are in the state of color and American Indian, as well as what the state teacher grant, student teaching grant program currently has funded over the biennium, and what some important facts are. I'm going to ask that you listen now to four teacher candidates talk about their experiences, and I'll entertain questions later about the bill that we've helped draft.
Thank you. Assalamu alaikum. If you could say your name for the record and who you're affiliated with, that would be helpful.
Okay. Hello, my name is Layla Sahal. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for having me today. My name is Layla Sahal, and I am in the Masters of Education program at Augsburg. I am working hard to get my, I'll be graduating this May to get my elementary license in K-6 teaching. This bill is very close to heart and very important to me because education is my passion. And ever since I was a little kid, I knew that I was destined for something greater than a purpose in life, to give back to my community. I came here when I was 4 years old by a single parent, raised by my mom, who always instilled in us that education is your ticket. And I believe that because important people were placed in my life, both educators and personal, that I was able to overcome so many challenges and so many road bumps that was put in place. I am the first person to graduate from college in my family. I am also the first person in my family to get my college, my graduate degree. And I am passionate about this because I wish that you can be a fly in the wall when I walk in a room, and that students see the, that you can see students of color when their lights, when they have lights in their eyes. I'm sorry, I'm a bit nervous. But it means a lot to have someone that they can relate to. It means a lot that they have someone that understands through their body language and through their speech and through their actions and through their cultures, things that are not very apparent to other teachers. And it removes from them a sense of anxiety. It removes a sense of their inability to find themselves in the classroom, because the one who's leading the classroom is relatable to them. And that's the core issue of why I'm here today. I come from a middle-class American family. My husband works two professional jobs. And during my student teaching position, you are required to be a full-time teacher, fulfill your coursework assignments, as well as plan lessons and activities. And during this time, it was very challenging for my household, because we were, I am a mother of four kids, so we would have to pay for child care expenses while I'm completing my student teaching position. And this has been a strain and a challenge for us as a family. I could not imagine how it would be for others who are less fortunate than myself, having the dream, having the passion, having the commitment, having the determination, the hard work, and the skills necessary to be an excellent teacher, but finances being the only reason, unfortunately, that would stop me from that. I am asking the community to support this bill, to support our teachers, to support our diverse body of students. I understand that increasing teachers of color is not the golden ticket to significantly impact the achievement gap, but I believe that it is a step in the right direction. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And who would like to go next and state their name and affiliation for the record? If we could ask everyone to try to keep their comments to about 2 minutes, that will help us be able to leave questions for members. That would be awesome.
Yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, good afternoon. My name is Ashley Dunlap, and I am currently a student at the Urban Teaching Program, preparing to be an elementary school teacher. As long as I can remember, I wanted to be a teacher. There's never been a plan B. Teaching, it's my passion. It's my gift. And I'm here because of the responsibility that I have to the education of young children of color, to my fellow teachers of color, and our community. I come from a middle-class family, and I was raised by parents who were the epitome of love and success and wisdom. But when I was 22 years old, I found myself sitting on a floor at a homeless shelter reading to children. And I was 8 months pregnant while my daughter was laying on my belly. I had just left an abusive relationship. I didn't have any money, and I didn't have any family or friends around to support me. But I knew even in that moment that there was something that was a higher purpose for myself. And to me, education was my way out. I had a dream, and I had this strong drive within my heart to be a teacher. I have something special to give to these children, but I didn't realize how difficult it was going to be able to attain resources to be able to pay for my books and for my classes. I didn't qualify for any loans or any grants, so the scholarships and the student teaching grants, like what's proposed in the bills, allows myself and allows others to have the financial means and necessary means to obtain our education so that we can one day share our passion to teach. Even though I had opportunities growing up that many children in urban settings didn't have, I still felt a very big disconnect to my teachers and to my education. At about 9 years of age, I began to ask myself, and I started to think critically, why don't I have any teachers that look like me? And this is something that affected me as a child. Throughout my entire K-12 journey, I had one teacher of color, and I was a junior at that time. And at that time, I felt so empowered, and I felt so happy to see someone that reflected and looked like who I was and who shared the same culture as me. Your support for the HF 434 can close this gap. With financial help, future candidates will feel empowered to pursue their calling to be as educators, knowing that the scholarships and the grants will help them to avoid digging into deeper debt, and it will give student teachers relief from the financial burden during student teaching when they must give their all to their students, but they're unable to work. I will be student teaching in the fall, and I can't even begin to explain the joy and the accomplishments that I feel. However, it also doesn't come without the anxiety and the stress from finances. As a student teacher, you're not paid. You're also not able to get a second job, and this is to ensure that you're able to give these students your all and that you're able to have this full-time commitment.
Ms. Dunlap?
Yes.
I'm enjoying your testimony. It's great. We've gone over an extra minute, and I just want to make sure we respect the other testifiers and make sure we get them in. So are you able to wrap up your remarks?
Yes, definitely.
Thank you.
Lastly, this bill will help our diverse candidates finish their journey and provide our children with what they deserve, and that's culturally competent and driven teachers who reflect the diversity and can show them that they, too, can overcome any obstacles that they face and become and achieve whatever it is that's set in their hearts. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello and welcome to our committee.
Hello.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Dietas White. Madam Chair and members, good afternoon. If I can find my way to afford it, I am planning to student teach in the fall to complete my urban teacher program at Metro State University to become an elementary teacher. I want to teach because it is important for students of color to see teachers of color. My experience in St. Paul Public Schools, I had a total of four teachers throughout my educational experience, three of them being African-American. I feel the most important part of my education, I don't see any teachers of color, which is in elementary. I know this from personal experience, and my daughter is here also because she hasn't seen any either. Yet we represent 4% of the teachers in the state of Minnesota, while the growing number of English learners and students of color in the Twin Cities and states throughout the state. Sorry, I'm
no
nervous
problem.
Trying to read it all. Get it out
doing
fast.
Great.
This means that there are more students of color that attend these schools. It is our job to do the right thing to meet the growing population of students of color with teachers of color. I would like to finish my educational goals and become a licensed urban education elementary teacher. I've been in school for 5 years, and I also have to work to support my family. I'm married with a family of five, and in order to meet my financial and educational goals, I've had to be a full-time student and work overnight while maintaining a 3.4 GPA. 3.42. I've exhausted my financial aid, and I'm currently making payments out of pocket for spring tuition right now, 2019. At the end, though, I will have completed my educational requirements. I would like to start student teaching the fall of 19 and graduate with a K-6 licensure. Fully supporting this bill and student teacher grant will not only benefit myself, but those who come after me with the same goals of becoming a teacher of color and meet their financial need. I am a semester away from graduating. The only thing left is to teach. I'm sure I'm going to make it. This bill will help students of color. It will lessen their burden when it comes to their financial situation. This will also decrease the amount of debt for future teachers of color facing the pressure of, teachers of color pursuing their teaching licensure. Thank you for your time. Sorry.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Got me going.
Now, how cool is this? A father-daughter? Is that what you said?
Yes.
That's
my daughter.
Oh, okay. I was like,
no.
I was trying to wrap my head around that. I'm glad I clarified that. Excellent. Welcome to our committee today, too.
He's not that old.
Okay, if you could state your name for the record as well.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Tricia Livingston. I am American Indian, and I'm enrolled at Metropolitan State Metropolitan State University. Sorry, I'm nervous too. And if all goes according to plan, I will be doing my student teaching in the spring of 2020. It hasn't been an easy ride to get here. I didn't go to college right after high school. I made other choices with my life, and I'm just very grateful that I've found my way. Gosh, now I'm like super nervous, and I like was super confident right before I started. Okay, so while I didn't have the most perfect experience in elementary and high school, I did have a few teachers that made a very large impact on my life. And when I decided to go back to college and I looked at my options, I knew that being a teacher was the only thing that I wanted to do because I wanted to be that kind of teacher for someone else. While I have the moral support of my family, they are unfortunately unable to financially support me. So I've been trying on my own to pay for my way, pay for my living and college expenses, but it's impossible to do without taking out loans. Currently, I have $60,000 in debt. I've exhausted all of my financial aid. Thank you. And I've never qualified for a Pell Grant because of my family's expected contribution, even though in reality it's actually nothing. I actually never even had an American Indian teacher until I got to college. And the feeling that that gave me was indescribable, really. I had never felt such a connection with someone before. So I just don't think that's okay, that there are students out there right now that have never had a teacher of color or of American Indian heritage. I think that needs to change. And hopefully with this bill, that can be a reality for other people. I could be that person for a future student of mine. Not only would it help me, it would help hundreds of other hopeful teachers as well. And I want you to think about them as well, because there are so many of us that want to do this. It's just not the easiest path. So please give your full support to this bill. It'll help so many people. And there is such a desperate need for quality teachers in this great state, and I'm really excited and grateful that I get to be one of them. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your testimony. It's very moving, and we appreciate you taking time out to testify before us today. We have Representative Pryor has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I can start with a comment, if that's all right, that just recently I met with a counselor at our middle school at Eden Prairie, one of our middle schools in my district, and he did talk about to me about how important it was that the system, you know, that we have in our schools reflect everybody that's in the school, and that you really can't do it unless, you know, the people that are part of that system and create the system have that those diverse backgrounds. And so I know, thank you, appreciate that providing this information about, I knew, but Eden Prairie is 41% students of color, and our Hopkins is 46, and Minnetonka is 16. So I know that in all the districts I represent, this is an issue. And I guess the question I have is, I know that we have, you know, other bills that are working through the system. I'm also on the K through 12 education committee, and I know that many of you are also were part of the testimony there, and I appreciate being able to hear the testimony again. Can you tell me the differences between, you know, the bills that are becoming through the K through 12 and then Representative Knorr, the bill and the information that we're asked to look at here, or if you have a testifier? Because just to know kind of where how these pieces fit together and can have the impact that we want as a state. And it's good to know that they're the same authors behind it or the same thinking behind it, and so that they are coordinated. And thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to ask a very broad question. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I would like Knorr. The testifiers to go broad because they went to K-12 and they can explain what took place.
Madam Chair, members, to answer your question, Representative Pryor, I want to refer everyone's attention to the one-page document that says Increased Teacher of Color Act on the top. And does everybody have that?
Yeah.
So in this package of programs, the higher ed portions are being heard today. Those are the student teacher candidate grants, the Aspiring Minnesota Teacher of Color Scholarships, and the Teacher Shortage Loan Forgiveness Programs. That's part of a whole big package of programs within the Increased Teacher of Color Act, and you're hearing the higher ed portions. Representative Nornes had the version of HF 434 that he led and introduced in 2017, and the language in the Delete All Amendment is the language that's from the Increased Teachers of Color Act, this broader bill that addresses the E-12 portions of this comprehensive effort.
And I just would like to mention, it does on the sheet, I don't see the loan forgiveness part listed. I just want to call that out, that it's like what I see, there should be one more bullet that says loan forgiveness one.
I'm sorry, it's not highlighted, Madam Chair, okay. Members. The second-to-last bullet on that page says strengthens and increases teacher shortage loan forgiveness program.
Thank you.
It wasn't highlighted.
No problem.
Okay. Madam Chair, it's important to note that some of these programs had appropriations from both E-12 and higher ed committees in the past, and so our goal with this is to have support from both E-12 and higher ed on these provisions. Again, we know the constraints, and we would like to have the as much funding as possible for these particular programs from the committee.
Thank you. Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Knorr, for introducing this bill and your work in this, and also I would like to thank all the testifiers. I have a sister who is a second grade teacher, and oftentimes she will go to bed later than I do, and we all here work very long hours. So teachers are the true change makers within our community, and so I appreciate all the work that you do. I think just one question, where just so everyone have a better understanding of like some of the experiences teachers of color go through within the system, what are some of the common barriers that you guys experience here?
Representative Vang, Chair Bernardi.
Yeah.
The biggest barriers are the financial barriers to become a teacher, and then the burden, the debt burden, once you are a teacher with a modest salary. But there are all these other programs that you see on this Increased Teacher of Color Act summary sheet address those other barriers, like the climate and curriculum in the schools, like the need for retention programs for teachers of color and American Indian teachers, like more Grow Your Own programs and the Collaborative Urban and Greater Minnesota Educator of Color program to have wraparound support while candidates are in college. So there's this comprehensive approach from high school all the way through teacher mentoring in the profession that addresses the main barriers. What we've done as a state is relatively few programs and small programs up to now, and this bill, this historic bill, takes a comprehensive approach with all of these various levers to finally start moving the needle.
Thank you. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I know that we've reached our time limit for this particular project, so I'll be quick. I have two main questions, and the first, I just want to commend you because you obviously spent a lot of work on this and revising it and refining it and so on. And it seems like a logical approach to addressing the gap, the achievement gap, to get more people of color in the classroom up front. But my question, and I've been involved in economic development for many years, and we've done other programs where in greater Minnesota we've had a shortage of a certain segment, and so we offer loan forgiveness for their student loans, for instance. And we always have a piece in there that if the professional moves out of the area, they need to repay the loan. So I see you have that in there. I would, before I ask my questions, I would just suggest maybe you consider a longer term. I see what you have in there is that if they leave within the first year, you know, I guess I would add a couple years to that, but just a suggestion to you. But my questions are on subdivision one, where it talks about scholarship program established. It says that it's in the teacher workforce who have demonstrated financial need, and then down under subdivision two for eligibility, number four, it says have an adjusted gross family income of $125,000 or less. So I'm asking, does $125,000 meet that demonstrated financial need criteria? How did you come up with $125,000?
Madam Chair, Representative, the consultation with the Office of Higher Ed gave us this kind of number where it would not exclude certain candidates who have financial need but have a expected family contribution gross income at this level. So in consultation with the Office of Higher Ed, what would be a sweet spot to, you know, address the needs of middle-class families and working-class families alike.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we don't have members having questions on here, but I wanted to ask a question. We talked about this in my office yesterday. Did you get a chance to look into the part about making sure we're not supplanting what private colleges would be putting? I want to make sure the dollars reach the students.
Yes, Madam Chair, yes, we did. We reached out to the Office of Higher Education, and we got a reply from that. I forwarded it to you, and
oh, good.
We have a representative here today to speak
you.
To that.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. So these scholarships would be significantly different from the previous conversation we had about emergency assistance grants. These would be awarded usually, typically, before the student starts a term, and they would be part of their financial aid package. So they would get their state grant and their Pell Grant, and then this might be an additional grant. They can only be awarded up to what's called the college or university cost of attendance, which is different from the state grant cost of attendance. But chances are this would mean the student would have less loan money in their package and perhaps less need to come up with earnings from work while enrolled. Does that answer your question?
I didn't. I mean, you probably explained it really well. I just didn't totally grasp it. I couldn't explain it to somebody else and say I have knowledge of it. So could anyone else explain it to me on the committee, or should I just ask her to explain it? Could you explain it again?
Okay.
Our bottom line is we want the money to get in the hands of the student.
Right. Yes. And that would happen.
Okay.
What happens is the financial aid administrator on the college or university campus puts together a package, a financial aid package. Typically, that would start with any Pell Grant or state grant the student would be eligible for. And then they would add on any, you know, scholarship from the campus that might be, you know, from donated funds or something like that. But even with all that, the chances are quite high that the student would still have room in what's called their cost of attendance for an additional scholarship, and probably the scholarship would end up reducing the amount they would need to borrow in student loans or reducing the amount they would need to earn from work while enrolled.
Okay, so Ms. Grimes, this will help me ask you this question. So we are confident that the scholarship students are receiving now to attend universities would remain the same amount, and the new scholarship would be on top of that. Because you see, I understand I do not want our new scholarships to reduce the scholarship students are already receiving at colleges and universities.
There might be rare circumstances in which they would bump up against the cost of attendance, but it's more likely in theory than in practice. The discussion that we had about emergency assistance grants and the fact that they might bump up against the cost of attendance was a different kind of grant, and that happens during a term where a student's award financial aid package had already been established. And I did talk with Minnesota State, and they assured me that it's their understanding that with something like an emergency grant, they would do what they call a temporary increase in the cost of attendance to account for whatever the student's emergency is, so that the student would, in fact, end up getting more money from the emergency grant. These kinds of grants, these scholarships, are different because they're put in the student's award package typically before they even start school in the fall. And so the pieces of it are all put together. Now, it is theoretically possible that a student would be getting so much in a privately donated scholarship or a college scholarship from donated funds that there might not be a full amount of the scholarship left. But this is what we call a last dollar scholarship, where we sort of get all the money the student is eligible to get from other sources and then fill in what's left for the cost of attendance.
Okay. And then can you just define just briefly cost of attendance?
Okay, so cost of attendance is tuition and required fees plus a living allowance. For the state grant program, that living allowance is a very frugal number that's around $10,000. For many of the colleges and universities, they use a somewhat higher living allowance that reflects the rents or so forth at where they are. And many campuses will have three different possibilities for a living allowance. One for students who are living on campus, one for students who are living at home with their parents, and one for students who are living on their own, who are often older students, age 25 or older.
Right. And then can you just reiterate, because I got some conflicting information than what I understood in a different meeting this week, the maximum amount a student can receive from a state grant is the cost of the University of Minnesota, regardless of what type of college they choose?
Madam Chair, the largest student grant, state grant a student would receive to attend the University of Minnesota is the highest they could receive, even if the same student were to attend a private college such as Gustavus.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a question to the bill author. Questioning that Representative Lehman had actually brought up a good point here in regards to the dollar amount threshold. So as I read it on the DE amendment, line 1.19 and 20, it's the adjusted gross family income. So is that across the board? So if I'm a family of six, a family of four, or if I'm unmarried, I'm just an individual, is it that same dollar amount that applies regardless of the number in that family?
Representative Noor.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, that is correct. Although I will have gone with the federal poverty guidelines, which will have changed the whole spectrum, but I think we have come to that final amount of $125,000.
Representative Lucero.
Okay, thank you, Manager. And just to clarify then, so a family of one, would that a person with $125,000 family income, if they're just an individual, are they still in poverty according to the federal poverty guidelines?
If you look at
Representative Noor.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, I think the key question here is they have demonstrated financial need. If an individual has got a financial need, then they do qualify to apply for the program. But that's the qualifier. Do they have demonstrated financial need to apply for the scholarship program?
And can we just call up the Office of Higher Education? I'm guessing that we're using similar standards that are used for our state grant program, right? So it's not changing any policy. It's replicating what we currently do in the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Right. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Different question and or second question. On line 1.15, I'm seeing another of the criteria is to self-identify as a teacher or to the teacher identification or preparation program as a person of color or American Indian. And when I think of the word self-identify, it has a different meaning today than it did in the past, I think, whereas we're seeing self-identification being very fluid among different attributes of a person, whether sexual preference, gender, age, ethnicity. So my question would be, can a person self-identify for purposes of qualifying, whatever it might take for the criteria to qualify, but then self-identify something else after they might have received the award?
Representative Noor.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, I think self-identifying is a big question that we've talked about in various committees. But the criteria is you identify yourself for who you are as a person of color or American Indian, then you qualify for the program. For you to go out of that parameter is not what we're looking forward to. So, no, you will not qualify if you're planning just to meet this qualification and then exclude yourself.
Representative Sarah, did you have a, is that a question? Is that a face that you want to ask another question?
Just for clarification then, so if the criteria is to self-identify, you just reference if a person isn't that criteria that you're looking for, a person of color, but if a person identifies as a person of color, is that not the only criteria for the minority status that you're looking for, or is there another criteria?
Go ahead, Ms.
Madam Chair, members. There are several criteria as listed here for the grant. As far as self-identification, I think we've had this question in past sessions, the fear that non-persons of color may identify as persons of color or American Indian to qualify for the scholarship. And I would like to offer that if you would like to identify as a person of color, you are a person of color. We're not going to tell you whether you are Latino or not, whether I'm Latina or not. We've had folks say, this person is blonde, blue-eyed. How can she be Mexican? Self-identification is the best way for us to identify ourselves instead of someone else telling us what we are. And this has been vetted, again, by hundreds of stakeholders. And most of the programs that are in this Increased Teachers of Color Act and some of the provisions included here do use self-identification as the guiding factor for that piece.
Okay, thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And because of questioning for Representative Lehman and Lucero, I recall that there are several occasions we've had presentations that touched on that, you know, 125. The one with the most graphical was the January 16 OHE overview, and on page 815, it shows the applicants and by the different types, and there it indicates that somewhere approximately 40K is where the independent, not married, without dependents dissipates to where it doesn't show. And it, the following slide on the bottom of that same page indicates the amount of grants that go out by income group. You may have remembered. And that will help you understand they have the 125, but with all the other mechanisms in the process, that this is sort of the distribution that actually comes out by family, because in the federal program they have a special thing that looks at size of family, and there are a lot of factors go into it, and we don't have the time for that, but so if you review previous testimony, you might be able to find clarification on some of those questions.
Thank you, Representative Quam. And then our last person on the list to ask a question is Representative Cleavorn.
I'll try to be short. I might need someone from higher education to come and help as well. So thank you, Madam Chair. So as I understand it, the university establishes the cost of attendance, and then first they would look to Pell.
Representative
Thank you. So whether we're talking private colleges or public institutions, I'm just trying to get my head around the question that Chair Bernardi asked, because we want to make sure that the student receives the maximum number of dollars. Mm-hmm. So if the university has established the cost of attendance, mm-hmm. then you said first they would have Pell money if they qualified for Pell.
Yes.
Then the state grant would come into play.
Yes.
And then you said campus scholarship. So maybe the institution itself has an endowment or donors that give money. And then this is where I get into trouble with Chair Bernardi's question. So then we have the delta between what's been granted in that student aid and what they still need to live and attend university. So this scholarship could fill that gap, or the institution could give a secondary scholarship of their own institution, correct? So this is where I'm getting into trouble. So my own child received a merit scholarship and an additional scholarship based on interest at the university he attended. If there were still a delta, would it be normal or customary for a university to extend to a student more than two scholarships, even if there were still a gap?
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, Representative Cleburne. Typically, the first step is the Pell Grant, the second step is the state grant.
Right.
For the University of Minnesota and for private colleges, there may well be institutional scholarship money. They would typically put as much in at that stage as much institutional scholarship money as they have available, and it might come from two or three different sources, like the Jane Jones Scholarship and the Patricia Grimes Scholarship or something. But they would typically add those together and put them in as a lump. Whether they would come back and do another round of that after something like Teachers of Color Scholarship was put in would frankly depend on how badly they wanted that student. There are very few institutional scholarships at Minnesota State institutions.
Okay. So then, may I ask one more?
Cleveland, please.
So then the other comment that you made was a phrase I'd never heard before, which was the last dollar scholarship, which I think is what we're hoping to be in this program. So how do we, is there language in this bill or language that is missing from this bill that would help us create that space for this to be the last dollar so that our outstanding students would be able to actually fulfill their goals? So that's my question. Is there language that we are missing here?
Madam Chair, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. I realize I didn't introduce myself the last time. I believe the language is already here. I have not read the bill within the last couple of days, so I'm having a little trouble remembering. But we do have other scholarships that we administer as last dollar scholarships. For example, the existing Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program, where basically the campus tells us all of the other aid the student is eligible for, what their total campus cost of attendance is, and then the difference is made up by the Indian Scholarship.
Okay. Thank you.
So this would be, we assume we would administer this in a similar way.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your patience. I appreciate it.
That's fine.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative Nora, would you like to make any closing statements?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As you can see, the emotions were running high. I think this is about our kids. It's about our children. It's about their future. And giving them the best education starts with the classroom. And having someone who will be able to guide them and help them is what we're looking forward. So, Madam Chair, as you renew your motion, I'm hoping that you can remove the possible from that statement. So thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. I would like to remove, and did we, I'd like to move your bill, House File 434, as amended, to be laid over for possible inclusion. The motion passes. I don't have to take a vote. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you.
Welcome to your committee, Vice Chair Pryor. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 2663 for possible inclusion.
Okay. Please present your bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2663 will improve the state grant program by increasing grants for the more than 80,000 students who currently get state grants and by making nearly 10,000 families, more families and students eligible. The state grant program provides Minnesota college students with need-based financial aid. Appropriations for the 2018-2019 biennium are $397 million, constituting a small share of the state's total higher ed spending, just 12%. It's the only part of the higher education budget that goes directly to students. The state grant program benefits more than 80,000 students each year. That's one out of four Minnesota students and undergraduates. Under this bill, 81 students would see an increase in their grants, and another 9,900 would become eligible for grants. It provides an important incentive to keep Minnesota's young people in our state by funding in-state residents. It helps students enroll both part-time and full-time at all kinds of colleges, public and private, two-year and four-year. It targets lower-income and middle-income families, with 60% of recipients' families making less than $40,000 a year. Most of these students would be eligible for federal Pell Grants as well. It provides support for middle-income families, with 30% of recipient families making between $40,000 and $80,000 a year. In total, 90% of state grant recipients have family incomes below $80,000 in Minnesota. The median family income is $86,400. I do have more introduction here, but I think you'd rather listen to the students, and I know that you've got your good research package that talks about this decreasing the amount that the students would be obligated to pay and the family would be obligated to pay when we calculate the grants, and that's the gist of what we're doing here. And I think I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Right, and Vice Chair Pryor, we want to make sure that you've clearly explained what this grant does. Did you clearly explain what factors you're doing to make it more accessible? Or make it more across more students?
So the student share is currently set at 50% of the total recognized cost of attendance, which consists of tuition plus living and miscellaneous expenses. And this bill reduces the student share from 50% of the total recognized cost of attendance to 46%. And then this, by the way, was the share from 2001 to 2013.
Okay.
So that's the student. And then, you know, as we actually heard from our teacher candidates before, when you have the higher obligation, if you are trying to pay for 50%, it means you have to make it up somehow. And students now are doing it by working or taking out loans. And this would reduce that burden for them. And then it also changes the families and reduces this bill increases the amount of a student's grant by reducing the family share in the state grant program. And I can say the bill uses the mechanism existing in the statute to increase state grants by reducing the amount Minnesota expects the family to pay, called the assigned family responsibility in Minnesota, by 5 percentage points. And together, these two changes would increase state grants for all current recipients, with the average state grants increasing by about $382. And these two changes would also make more students eligible to receive state grants.
Okay, thank you. Was that the part you cut out in your introduction?
Yeah.
Important part. Thank you very much. Okay, so we're going to try to stick to two-minute testimony. And so if you could help us up on that, because we need to gain time in our meeting time here. Thank you.
Okay. Katie Seeger from St. Catherine University. Hello, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for letting me testify this afternoon. My name is Katie Seeger, and I'm a senior at St. Catherine University, and I will be graduating this May with a degree in social work. I will be continuing my education with a master's in social work at St. Kate's again this fall to pursue my goal of becoming a clinical social worker. I graduated from Kenyon-Wanamingo High School in 2016, and my parents currently reside in Morristown, Minnesota, about an hour south of here. My dad works in heating and cooling, though he's currently laid off, and my stepmom works at a small thrift store. I have a twin sister who also attends St. Kate's for business administration and marketing, and my brother attends Gustavus Adolphus for elementary education. Right out of high school, I attended Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I really loved it there, but I transferred after just one semester because it was too expensive. You see, after being a first-generation college student, I didn't know what expensive truly meant. So within the first few weeks of my attendance, I knew I made a mistake, and I knew I was going to transfer. As I researched, I learned about the Minnesota State Grant and narrowed my list down to just Minnesota colleges. And while looking, St. Kate's quickly came to the top of my list. I picked St. Kate's for a variety of reasons. Perhaps the largest reason is the mission of the university, to educate women to lead and influence. This is extremely empowering as a woman to know that my education is valued at an institution and that my ideas matter. I also knew that I wanted a university where my voice and opinions would be welcome and encouraged, and that is why I'm here today. Throughout my 2.5 years at St. Kate's, I've been involved in a variety of areas outside of the classroom. I've been a member of our Student Senate, Improvements Chair and Vice President of our Residence Hall Association, and inducted into two National Honor Societies. I've attended three regional and national leadership conferences, one that I was able to present at, and I've been able to attend a National Women's Convention as well. I've had the opportunity to intern at two agencies through my social work program. Last year, I interned at Little Brothers Friends of the Elderly, and this year, I'm a social services intern at Shaler Shalom Home East. On campus, I have two jobs. I work at St. Kate's Early Childhood Center with preschool-age children, and I also work in our admissions office, where I give tours to Minnesota high school students excited about their experiences that they'll have at St. Kate's. All of these experiences, and many more, have better prepared me to enter the Minnesota workforce. I never would have had any of these experiences had I not attended St. Kate's, and I never would have attended St. Kate's without the help of the Minnesota State Grant. I cannot stress enough how much this grant has helped me succeed. My siblings and I are the first
in our family. I'm going to need you to wrap up your remarks.
Gotcha. Let's see. I ask you all to continue to support the Minnesota State Grant by supporting House File 2663 to be able to benefit other students and Minnesotans just like me. Thank you for funding the state grant, and thank you for letting me testify today.
Thank you very much. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Abdi Badri, and I'm a second-year student at Hamline University. I'm studying political science and legal studies with a minor in global studies. I chose Hamline University because it seemed like the perfect fit for me. The small class sizes, the personalized learning, and the local campuses and the local campus all made Hamline what it is. Once I graduated Robbinsdale Armstrong High School in 2017, I knew that I couldn't afford to live anywhere other than home. Despite cutting out on-campus housing expenses and having multiple scholarships and grants, including the state grant, it had been very difficult for me to pay for college. I was fortunate and quite frankly lucky to have the support of family and friends in dealing with these costs. I currently work three jobs, two paid internships and one work study, to sustain myself, on top of a full course load and numerous leadership positions on and off campus. I'm a Capital Pathways intern. I also intern for the Office of Mayor Melvin Carter. I work on campus with the McVeigh Youth Partnership to provide mentorship and after-school programming to St. Paul Youth. I serve on the Executive Board of Hamline Student Congress as the Political Affairs Chair, in which I'm responsible for organizing and facilitating student Congress elections, as well as spearheading voter outreach and get-out-the-vote efforts for midterm elections. I'm also the Vice President for the African Student Union, where I'm responsible for organizing cultural and educational programs and events. I'm on the Model United Nations team and will represent Hamline with a group of students at the National Model UN Conference in New York next week. Outside of school, I serve on the Board of Directors for the Seven Dreams Education Foundation, In this role, I help plan and execute multiple fundraisers to raise money and provide hands-on learning grants to our Robbinsdale schools, teachers, and students. I'm also in the Education Policy Fellowship Program with the Center for Policy Design. I know that my situation would be far worse without the state grant, but I also know that it could be better for students like me if there was increased funding for the program. I'm a first-generation college student, and without the support of the state grant, neither me or my three siblings could afford to attend and finish college. It was hard enough getting to college to begin with. I was involved with college readiness programs like Avid and College Possible, which helped me gear up for the college experience. Hamline, being a small liberal arts school, gave me the opportunity to study under the most experienced and qualified professors while being supported. Attending Hamline University allows me to pursue my dreams of working on human rights and education policy with the hopes for becoming a human rights lawyer. I'm extremely grateful for the state grant and the investment Minnesota has made in my education. The state grant makes it easier for me to pursue my education so I can give back to my community the same way it gave to me. Yes. Thank you for the opportunity to testify and share my story.
Thank you very much. And to our next testifier, please state your name for the record and your affiliation.
Wendy Tay-Tay, the College of St. Benedict. Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Wendy Tay-Tay, and I am a senior at the College of St. Benedict, St. John's University. In a few weeks, I will be graduating with an accounting degree. I'm looking forward to working in the accounting field, and I am excited to hear back regarding an interview I had last week with Minnesota Management and Budget. I hail from Lagos, Nigeria. I lived there for 11 years of my life and then moved to Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. I graduated from Park Center Senior High in 2015. It is an honor to be testifying today. I was ecstatic when I was offered the opportunity. My brain was saying yes faster than my thumbs could type it. The College of St. Benedict has always provided me with many opportunities that I am very thankful for. If I begin to list them out, we might be here for a very long time. I was involved in a college prep program called Upper Bound. Within this program, I had the opportunity to visit many colleges, both public and private. These visits began when I was a ninth grader and continued until my senior year of high school. Throughout these visits, I had two friends that I would always be around during these tours. For some unspoken reason, when I visited CSBSJU my senior year of high school, both my friends were sick for the day. Therefore, I was on this college tour by myself. As you can guess, I was very attentive, intrigued, and I fell in love with the campus and the community by the end of the tour. When I got home, I was almost screaming to the entire Brooklyn Park community that I had finally found the place I wanted to call home for 4 years. Imagine the immense pressure that was lifted off me. Then reality set in. I'm from a family of eight. Both my parents are pursuing higher education due to being newly relocated immigrants. My two older sisters are also pursuing higher education. Let me set the picture for you all. My family was about to break my heart and tell me that I could not attend the school that I so dreamed of because of the concern that my family could not afford it. After a conversation I had with my mom, I began applying for other safety net schools that were more affordable. I waited for a while, unsure of where I was going to go. Then came the light. I received my financial aid award packet. In addition to the aid provided by my school, I received the Minnesota State Grant. I can confidently say that if I did not receive that grant, I would have not called CSBSJU my home for the past 4 years. CSBSJU has created an environment for me to thrive, think critically, and even challenge our Benedictine community. In return, I have been involved in the continuous pursuit of increasing cultural agility and competency through my work as a student liaison in the Intercultural International Student Services Office, the Cultural Affairs Board, and my current position as the President of the Student Senate. The strong leader, communicator, and sometimes funny.
Ms. Tay-Tay, I'm going to need you to wrap up your comments. Thank you very much.
The person I am today is in part due to the financial assistance I have received for the past 4 years. I will continue to give back to the Minnesota community and assist in building our future generations to be the best that we can be. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, there was a question that after they finished the testimony, but for the bill author.
Okay. Is there more testimony?
Good afternoon, and thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Mary Dana Hinton, the president of the College of St. Benedict and the chair of the board of the Minnesota Private College Council. I'm delighted to be with you today and just want to share that while we often think of our post-secondary or higher education institutions as individual campuses, in reality, we are part of an interconnected tapestry, including our campuses, our local and regional communities, and the people of the state of Minnesota. I'm reminded of this because last January, the St. Cloud Times ran an article that featured Dr. Anissa Cheek, president of the St. Cloud Technical and Community College, Dr. Robin Wacker, president of St. Cloud State University, and myself. The article actually said very little about our individual institutions and instead spoke about the commitments, ideas, and ideals that bind us. And while we have different platforms from which we accomplish our mission, each of us would say that our call as higher education leaders is to ensure educational equity and that we have a shared commitment and obligation to the people of Minnesota. Please know that as we think about the Minnesota State Grant Program, we are thinking about investing in our residents and our taxpayers in Minnesota. I share this anecdote because our communities, our colleges, and our universities work diligently to close the attainment gap we've experienced in Minnesota and to provide equity. A few numbers in addition to what Representative Pryor already shared about the state grant. Minnesota private colleges confer 30% of all bachelor's degrees in the state, yet only 3% of higher education funding goes to Minnesota students at private colleges. At the College of St. Benedict, 75% of our students come from Minnesota. 20% of private college students are first generation. At St. Ben's, that's 30%. We serve equal numbers of students of color and American Indian students at private colleges. We serve approximately 23% of our student body are American students of color or American Indians. At the University of Minnesota, that's 22%, and 21% at Minnesota State. And our graduation rates for these populations exceed those of other sectors. At the private colleges, we graduate our students of color and Native American students at 54% within 4 years. At the U, that number is 47%. At Minnesota State, it's 12%. I am delighted and proud to say that at St. Ben's in the class of 2018, 82% of our students completed their degree in 4 years, and we are closing the retention gap between American students of color and majority students. Finally, with regards to low-income students, and we've talked about Pell Grant or heard about it in other testimony, those are families that have average incomes under $50,000. We enroll equal percentages of Pell Grant students at Minnesota privates as at other groups. 27% of our student body at private colleges are Pell eligible, compared with 17% at the U, 27% at Minnesota State, and 29% at Minnesota State Colleges. At St. Ben's, that number is about 28%. And once again, we graduate students at much higher rates. Overall, at private colleges, Pell-eligible students graduate at 54% within 4 years, compared to 40% at the U, 18% at Minnesota State Universities. And at St. Ben's, our Pell graduation rate is 71% in 4 years and 80% in 6 years. I will end then and invite questions. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Very good. Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Quam, did you want to ask your question?
Certainly. I've got two now. Looking at the bill, I noticed that there is no dollar amount. So I'm assuming that it'll be incorporated and take part of the budget. Is the intent of the chair that there'd be a 5% increase since we're decreasing or we're increasing across the board 5%, or is there going to be a 5% decrease in number of recipients?
Representative Pryor, have you done any analysis on that, what the funding it would take to fund this to make sure all students that currently receive money? Is that what you're asking, Representative Quam?
Yes, Madam Chair. Okay. Clarifications.
Madam Chair,
yes,
if I may, I'm Paul Cirkvenek, President of the Minnesota Private College Council. Madam Chair and Representative Kwan and members. This bill, if fully funded, would cost about $92 million in the next biennium. It's a request to fully fund the decrease in the student share and the family share. We would not want legislation adopted that would reduce the number of recipients or the grants for any students. This is a request to do more in the grant program, and it takes more funding. And if the additional funding is not there, then, of course, we wouldn't want the numbers changed.
And thank you very much. I didn't realize there is, I didn't hear that there was a fiscal note, and there is a fiscal note, so you can look in your packet on what it says.
Madam Chair, I did notice the fiscal note. I'm used to a bill actually indicating in the bill and not have the dollar appropriation, being separate. That's why I asked the question. My first term on here. Mm-hmm. And then I believe it was President Hilton had commented about some graduation rates, and that data looked different than what was given us back in January. And I was hoping that possibly that she could forward what she's utilizing as a reference material to the committee so it could be distributed, so I can better understand the discrepancies between mm-hmm. the OHE and what was quoted.
We can forward that information, Madam Chair and Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair, if I may, too. And you're right, I know that you'll appreciate looking at that because sometimes it's the definition of when you're talking about graduation rates, and that there are six-year graduation rates, four-year graduation rates, and it's good to know that the comparisons are apples to apples.
Thank you. We have no one else left on questions for you, so if you could do your closing remarks, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Deborah, for your attention and support. And I renew my motion to lay over House File 2663.
Okay. Well, hearing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion, or Representative Pryor's motion for House File 2663 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Omnibus Bill. Thank you very much. Okay. Representative Woldemott. Welcome to your committee, Representative Wolgamott. Would you like to move your House file?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would love to move my House file.
Okay, so Representative Wolgamott moves House File 2730 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
And I have an amendment, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay. So we will check that one out. Would you like to move your...
Madam Chair?
Amendment? Okay, so this is all coming back to me. This was an amendment that was received today, and Sean Herring, our committee administrator, talked to Representative Norness and asked him if he would allow this to be accepted in the committee, and he did give his approval. So that's...
Madam Chair?
Yeah, go ahead, Representative Kwong.
On line 1.2 of the amendment, after the first... after the two faculty, there should be a comma. So provide two faculty, comma, to identify, comma, review, comma.
Is that a friendly amendment, Representative Wolf?
It's a technical correction.
Okay.
So
I'll accept it. Thank you, Representative Kwong.
Mr. Savory, is that, do we need to add that in there?
No.
Madam Chair, I would refer to my colleague on this.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McCormick, who is sitting in for Nathan Hopkins today. Thank you
Madam
for being
Chair,
here.
Members, I don't think that a comma is necessary, but if it doesn't hurt either.
Okay, so we have some friendly agreements going on. We might as well put the comma in and move forward. All those in favor of the... Oh, did you want to talk about... the amendment, or do we want to get in the author's? Just get in the author's tape if you don't mind.
It's a pretty straightforward amendment, just to further clarify the intent of the bill.
Okay, so to get it in the author's, the shape the author would like. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay. All those opposed?
No.
Okay.
I think
it.
Need it.
Oh. Right.
Actually.
Okay. So. Okay, so that motion passes, and I just want to talk to our staff. It was a friendly amendment that was already accepted. Do I have to do the comma as a separate motion, or I just pass the whole amendment as needed?
I'm sure you've incorporated the comma as part of the amendment.
Right, so it has been passed, and we can move forward with your bill.
All right, okay. Madam Chair, committee members, I'm excited to present House File 2730, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities Open Textbook Program. Since we're over time, I will very much condense my presentation. The bill accomplishes three main things. It provides incentives for faculty to review, adapt, adopt, or create open textbooks. It provides academic departments incentives to review, adapt, adopt, or create open textbooks across their curricula. And it provides grants to faculty in high enrollment courses the opportunity to create a new open textbook that will be shared across the system for other faculty to use if they choose. And I will also note that the bill is supported by students, faculty, and the system. And with that, for the interest of time, I will close my comments and present my testifiers here today, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Who would like to start? Is it Kim Lynch, if you could say your name for the record and your affiliation.
Good afternoon, everyone, Madam Chair. My name is Kim Lynch, and I'm the Senior System Director for Educational Innovation at Minnesota State. As you may be very well aware, with the exorbitant cost of textbooks is a significant barrier for college students. With the average yearly cost of textbooks well over $1,200, some of our students literally choose between food and books. Recognizing this obstacle, Minnesota State promotes textbook affordability by supporting and facilitating the adoption of free, open, high-quality materials called Open Educational Resources, or OER for short. I'd like to share a bit about Minnesota State's work to date to understand how this bill will accelerate our current momentum. When we began promoting the value of open educational resources about 4 years ago, very few faculty in our system had even heard of them. That's really starting to change. And we've done some of that awareness building and those actual savings through a variety of efforts. I'm just going to rattle through a few of them again, mainly just to help you understand the foundation that we're developing and how this bill would really complement or actually accelerate that. We do OER webinars. We do featured keynote speakers at all of our conferences over the last 4 or 5 years, campus visits and presentations, educating faculty development campus leaders, partnering with our student association on an OER symposium, and a widely shared promotional video showing that deep need that students have. Campus grants that achieved a 42% return on investment in student state savings, and promotional videos showing those successes. Stories of innovation in OER saturated through our academic and student affairs committees. Funding through Open Textbook Library to support textbook reviews, funding in support of learning circles to assist faculty in adapting, and authoring text, connecting library staff from across the system to be effective partners in this work, sponsoring 38 faculty and library staff to become certified Creative Commons licensing in Creative Commons licensing so they can help faculty and grow campus expertise. And then lastly, we've also done some work with technology advancements that will help faculty search for OER through our recently implemented library system. It was recently upgraded, and we now have the ability to do that. And we are providing we will soon be providing students the ability to search prior to registering for those courses that use those free, affordable textbooks. And again, I just mention all that to say that we've been building a foundation, and that that is a foundation that's really required to achieve widespread results. With this bill, we would continue our existing efforts and then be able to extend strategically to do much more and actually see those savings that make a real difference to our students. Again, the real barriers to student success, to retention, to completion when they can't afford their textbooks. And so we just really want to thank you as a representative of Minnesota State for considering this bill that we think could really accomplish much in terms of student savings.
Thank you for your testimony. And Derb Bowen, right?
Right.
I usually call you by your first name. Yes. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Jonathan Bowen. I represent the Interfaculty Organization. We are the union that represents the approximately 4,000 professors, coaches, counselors, and librarians at the state universities. I am here today, one, to lend our support to this bill. We think it's a great idea, and also to thank Representative Wolgamott for his leadership to bring together students, faculty, and the system around what can often be a contentious issue. Adopting new textbooks or course materials into a curriculum is an incredible amount of work and can take a lot of time. And this program will help expand and provide opportunities for faculty to consider free open textbooks and course materials and save students an incredible amount of money, and we're happy to be here to support it.
Okay, thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author. In general business applications, there's the capability of shared documentation where you can highlight, make notes, comments, add attributes. I would think that this tool should have the capability to where each person would log in and be able to have that, and be able to keep track. But also, you have the capability of collaborative. So if you have a study group and you're given permission, you'd be able to see. I hope that that is looked at as a functionality for this. And I apologize for going over the 24 words.
Very close, Representative Quam. I was counting. No, I really wasn't. Representative Overmont.
Yeah, thank you. I would agree. We should take a look at that.
Okay. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have just a few questions here for the bill author. The first is, it looks like the appropriation is $500,000 over the biennium. How did you arrive at that $250 per year in the biennium?
I arrived in that with thank you, Madam Chair. I arrived in that in consultation with the with my conversations, looking at the need with students, with faculty, and with the system. So maybe if they would like to speak to that.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I can talk a little bit. I talked about strategically extending what work has already been done, and a few of those areas would be the Open Textbook Network currently offers faculty $200 to review potential textbooks. This additional funding would help move about 50 to 60% of them actually then adopt. What we're trying to do is to figure out how to bridge that gap between reviewing and adoption. So faculty who are already interested, this would help move them beyond and do some of the work that Mr. Bone mentioned as far as moving faculty to that next step. In addition to that, we've had a successful model of learning circles at the system level to get faculty to work together on adapting and authoring and modifying. And we see this funding has helped scaling that system model to be offered for local leaders at the campuses so that they would have their own network of support there. We've also seen that, as I mentioned, a 42% return on investment when we have funded local efforts at our campuses, and so we would aim to expand that as well to provide what we've already seen work as successful to do more of that. We also see that new in this bill, funding to accelerate or sustain campus academic programs. We've not tackled this at the program or department level previously, and we see that offers some gains both for the impact and for the momentum with faculty working with one another to expedite awareness and adoption. And lastly, it also talks about high enrollment academic programs. Ideally, we look at these across university and college sectors so that we were bringing folks together who were working in similar courses across our college and universities to both collaborate and identify areas where they could really make great gains because the courses themselves are very high enrollment and therefore have a great impact on student costs. So those are a few of the areas that we've looked at when we were consulted on this bill.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lucero?
I think I have several additional questions for the bill author. So it sounds like, based on what was just mentioned by the testifier, that there is a program in place to some degree. Dollars are being spent on it. To help myself and the committee fully understand, to put the $250,000 per year into perspective, what is the dollar amount that's presently being spent on the system per year?
Representative Wolgemont.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Lucero. I don't have that figure with me at this time. I'll defer to the testifiers if they have any input.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, we currently, for the past 2 years, we have put $250,000 per year to this effort, and we also received legislative funding in, I believe it was FY 17, maybe 16, I'm wrong with that. And we spent that, it was $200,000, $100 per year, and that was for some of those efforts that I mentioned, the textbook reviews and for the campus grants. And the work that we provided, the $250,000 each year, has been to do the extended work with campus grants and with some of the faculty learning circles and faculty work. So that's been the commitment that we have placed toward it to date.
Representative Cerro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so this effectively will double what's being spent, is what I'm hearing. Okay, then when it comes to just reading the bill language here, line 1.19, open copyright license, I'm not super familiar with that, so I'm just curious then, does that allow anybody to go in and alter content within textbooks that would be used under the open copyright license? And to what degree, I did hear that you mentioned that there's peer review. To what extent does that peer review filter into changing potentially incorrect information within the content?
Ms. Lynch.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, the way Creative Commons works is that once an author, whoever owns the copyright, chooses to put it into the Creative Commons space. They still retain copyright, but it then allows them to freely share it under some provisions in terms of mainly attribution, citing who it's from. It also often allows them to adapt it. So the peer review is based on whatever is put in the space, in this case the Open Textbook Library at the University of Minnesota, and the review is there so that those who are looking to see what they might choose, they have that those peer reviews by other faculty members in front of them when they're making their decision. When they choose to adopt it, because it is Creative Commons licensed, they have the flexibility with attributing what they're using to adjust it to a degree that makes sense for working with their class. This really allows them to do what faculty sometimes do separately from their materials, to do it directly into those materials that are being used. One of the things at Minnesota State that we found particularly exciting about this is that it's really forwarded some of our equity issues, where faculty have chosen to really modify their content to meet the students in front of them so that the case studies are culturally relevant, that they really match, which we're unable to do with publisher materials because what you get is what you get. They aren't modifiable. So it's through the licensing called Creative Commons licensing that allows within parameters, it isn't just a free-for-all, but they have to fit the attribution requirements or the terms of those licenses to do that modification.
And one last question,
yes,
Madam Chair.
Representative Lucero.
And I appreciate the indulgence. So then with the current $250 per year that's being spent on the current system, what is there any numbers out there on what percentage of textbooks that are being used under the open copyright license as compared to the whole within the MinSCU system?
Ms. Lynch.
Madam Chair and members, I don't, it's a hard number to grasp for the entire system. We did work with those who we knew were doing some work through the things that we funded, and so we had a fairly extensive self-report survey that showed that over FY18 we saved $1 million in the folks that reported and that had been participating with us in one form or another. So it's I hesitate to say that broadly because some just didn't report and others are doing it that may have come accessed open resources in ways that we didn't know. And the thing that I think, one thing that I think that's important to note about a savings like that is Jonathan mentioned how difficult it is or how much work it is to adopt new textbooks or new materials for a course. But the good news is once a faculty member does shift to open resources, they often stay with it. So those savings repeat year after year. It's not a one-time savings, but one that continues year after year.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that was an important answer, but the numbers I was referring to is, to clarify my question, are open textbooks 1% right now of what's being used? Is it 10% of textbooks being used, et cetera, if that number is available?
Madam Chair, members, that we don't know that.
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Bowen.
Yeah, just really quick on that point. The one part of the data that is clear is that the more faculty that have the opportunity to learn about open textbooks, adopt them into their courses. So the more opportunities faculty have to see them, to learn how they work, the more faculty end up adopting them into their coursework.
Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very quickly, are these actually textbooks? You're publishing them, or are these
online curriculum?
Ms. Lynch.
Madam Chair, members, it's a little bit of both, actually. In the world of open educational resources, there's a broad range of textbooks and ancillary materials, including full courses. We did receive a grant from the Achieving the Dream Foundation, where we now, as of fall 19, will have an entire online program for an associate's degree, completely using open resources and their full curriculum. So it really widely varies, but we see the greatest cost savings in the textbooks, and that's why that's the area where we've really been focusing our efforts. But in terms of the arena of open educational resources, it's much broader. Also, Madam Chair, if I could, I actually have an additional response that might be helpful to the previous question about the percentage.
Sure.
So in addition to what I mentioned, I talked about some technology enhancements that are in the works. One of them is to work with our bookstores so that in the future, and it's a little bit out because our IT, it's a fairly big IT project, the cost of textbook will be apparent in the registration portal in a field in our record system. And once that actually starts to be completed and populated, we then are able to pull that data in ways that right now our bookstores are so independently run and separate that we don't have a common data source to know what's the total cost of textbooks that are being out there and what is it that faculty are using that are free or open. So we've started the process to get to where we can actually get those numbers, but currently we just don't have a way to access that systematically.
Okay, well, thank you, members. Would you like to wrap up any comments on your bill, Representative Wolgamott?
Wait, hold on.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, okay, thank you. I'm sorry. We do. Been such a busy schedule, I forgot to ask. Is there anyone else who would like to testify before this bill? And I did have your name, and it might be Christopher David. Is that right? Yeah, thank you so much. I'm sorry I didn't see that. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your affiliation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Christopher David. I'm a South Minneapolis resident and a student at Minneapolis Community Integral College in downtown Minneapolis. So I currently have a course that uses an open textbook. It's a college algebra course at MCTC. This textbook is the printed copy. I had to get this for like $55 on Amazon. If you want to deal with an ebook, you can get that for free. Issues with the ebook, I will say, is that oftentimes it's hard to do, particularly a course like math, on just a computer screen. If you want to have it printed out and you don't want to go to Amazon and get this, you can print it out on the printers. And at school, they basically give you like $100 credit that you could essentially use for that with your student fees. Now, of course, people are going to be printing a significantly larger amount if they are going to print a lot of this book than if they would otherwise. So that is an expense that should be considered. Additionally, the quality of this book, frankly, it's okay. It's not the best in the world. There are some errors. There's some things that don't exactly convey things as well as I would hope they would. And I actually went out and also online and bought an old version of the textbook that they had used immediately prior to adopting this, which was made by the large textbook company Pearson. And fortunately, I had the ability to do that, and it has helped to augment with that material. Part of the reason why I had to augment with that material is because the instructor is relatively new to using this material, and their lesson plans and some of the stuff that they have online in the D2L, which is like our online portal, is developed directly related to the way that the last book was structured. And they haven't yet adopted the curriculum to the point where it's completely aligned with this, which is sort of what one of the testifiers was saying. They're right. It does take a good amount of time. I would say it does create stressful situations for students like me when we're in the kind of adoption period. I would say that in my estimation, in addition, I think this is a decent bill. I'm glad Representative Wolgamott brought it forward. I would say that in addition, though, to just talking about the textbooks, you would also want to talk about electronic resources and specifically maybe fund some of those things. It doesn't necessarily work the best for me to use things like My Math Lab or other courseware materials, but for many students, they swear by it. And there aren't necessarily online courseware materials that are fully developed for some of these open format things. And that's something that should be funded as well. We don't want to just talk about, a textbook or this or that. And ultimately, I'm looking forward to, if this were to pass, I'm looking forward to seeing what the different reports are that come back to you guys, because it would be interesting to learn what has been developed and whether or not there should be a larger appropriation in the future. Because I think if we're going in this direction, it would be nice to have a really good system and work for the highest quality textbooks, not necessarily just the cheapest, because if you look at the economic calculation, it's more expensive if you end up having people fail or withdraw and then they have to retake the course. I'd much rather them pay if they have to. I'm not saying they should have to pay per se for the textbooks, but if they do have to do that, I'd rather than pay for the textbooks, get A's, B's, and maybe C's, and pass, then have to retake them.
Okay,
thank you, Committee.
Yeah, I appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, thank you very much. Representative Wolgamott?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for staying over to hear this. I'm proud of the work that this committee is doing to stop increases in tuition. But I have heard from so many constituents in my district and here in our committee about the need to do something to address the cost of textbooks. So, Madam Chair and members, I ask that you support this bill, and I thank you for hearing it today and for accepting my amendment with the quama.
that was the best all year. Okay, so Representative Wolgamott, would you like to renew your motion for House File 2730 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the higher omnibus? Thank you for moving that. The motion passes. Okay, and so thank you, members, for sticking with us. We had a big agenda today, and the meeting is adjourned.